Mike, the floor is yours.
Okay, great. So hopefully everybody got the PDF, and some of the slides actually don't have numbers on them. So if you can follow me along with the PDF numbering system, and it starts out with the title slide, which is Human Exploration of Phobos. And then if you go quickly to slide 2, I will tell you that this is the results of the work of a large team across the agency. It's part of the Evolvable Mars campaign. Really a great team. I'm totally impressed by the and inspired by the effort that these guys have put into this study. This is one of many paths that are being looked at on the Evolvable Mars campaign, and I wanted to just clarify for the record that this is not like, you know, the chosen path toward Mars surface. We're still looking at a bunch of different trades, so this represents a series of options that might be considered. Okay, going on to slide 3. I think most of you know this. Mars has 2 moons, Phobos and Deimos. Phobos is roughly 27 by 22 kilometers. Deimos is about half of that. I won't say a whole lot more about them at this point. And so let's go forward to slide 4. And so Mars moons are interesting scientifically. They potentially offer engineering, operational, and public engagement benefits that could enhance a subsequent Mars surface operation. Mars moons are interesting in themselves, but also like to provide insights into the evolution of Mars. And there's really multiple scientific benefits. You know, the moons of Mars are possibly captured asteroids. They likely contain some Mars surface materials, also materials collected from the asteroid belt. And then they offer the opportunity for near-zero latency teleoperations of Mars surface assets that could be enabling for subsequent human surface missions. So it's potentially an affordable and productive first step towards an eventual Mars surface operation. The other thing is it provides significant radiation protection. I'll talk about that in more detail. They also say that Phobos and Deimos are both interesting exploration destinations. And with the current imagery, we know Phobos is interesting because of the craters and the fissures and the monoliths. And it's also the driving transportation case, and therefore the focus of our study was Phobos. We are in the process of formulating and discussing a precursor mission that would look at both moons. Okay, that's it for slide 4. So now on to slide 5. And if I'm going too fast or whatever, feel free to jump in. So when we started this study, I wanted to get an intuitive sense of what the gravity would be like on Phobos. You know, having done a lot of lunar sims and Mars sims and actual microgravity EVAs, I just wanted to get a sense of what it was like. And this slide kind of overviews that. If you look in the lower left corner, a crew member in a suit would weigh about 0.3 pounds. A space exploration class vehicle would weigh about 8 pounds. 15-ton habitat would weigh, you know, just under 20 pounds, and a 50-ton lander would weigh about 65 pounds. And then to the right, we looked at maximum vertical takeoff at 2 meters per second. That's like Michael Jordan kind of jumping. That's about as good as a human can do. But on Earth's moon, if you did that, you would go up about 1.2 meters, and your time of flight would be 2.5 seconds. And the picture in the background shows John Young floating a flag, and that was about a meter or so close there. On Phobos, you would go up 350 meters, and your round-trip time of flight would be just under 12 minutes. And on Deimos, roughly twice that and twice the round-trip time. So there's definitely gravity, but there's not a lot of it. And the challenge in the study was to figure out how to make that, you know, how to take advantage of the gravity and make it work for you. Okay, that's the end of slide 5, so on to slide 6. And this basically overviews the trade space of the first year of this study. We've gone on since then, but I'll talk to this. So destinations, we looked at Phobos and Deimos only or Phobos and Deimos together. Transportation, conjunction class, and then we actually started out looking at some free return trajectories and ended up getting guidance from headquarters to look at conjunction class only. So that's what we looked at. Then in terms of pre-staged assets, we evaluated nothing pre-staged, a Mars Moon habitat, and then a Mars Moon habitat plus pressurized excursion vehicles or other exploration systems. For the Mars Moon habitat, we looked at both surface habitat that would be static or relocatable, and then we looked at park in the habitat at various points from L4, L5, and then some lower DROs. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the DRO, so I'll cover the L4, L5 right now. They're basically too far away. It took, you know, days to get to the surface and back, and so you were burning a lot of prop going back and forth from the half, and it, you know, any prop savings you got from parking it at the Lagrange point was overshadowed by going back and forth. And also the radiation protection fell off significantly. L1 is really interesting on Phobos because it's about 2 kilometers from the surface, or actually from the centroid. And so at first we were very intrigued with that. You know, you could park your hab there, you could have a space elevator. You know, we certainly have the technology to do a couple kilometer cable. But as we looked at that more, there's a fair amount of burns you have to do depending on how often you do them and the magnitude and so forth. And, if you happen to have a thruster fail on and you're on this tether, you know, you end up doing a face plant into the planet. So as cool as that was, we kind of ruled that out. So, I'll talk more about the DRO and the surface going forward. And then as far as what we call exploration work systems, we looked at a range of things from absolute minimum like jetpacks to unpressurized excursion vehicles that would be similar to the Apollo rovers, pressurized excursion vehicles that would break down into an SEV or SpaceX exploration vehicle class, or Mars lander, Mars asset vehicle class. So now on to slide 7. And when you get there, this is an eye chart, but it talks about radiation exposure. And I'm not going to read all this, but I'll make a couple high-level points. So we look at different Earth departure dates. So there's different round trip durations, different time in the Mars system on the Mars Moon. And the bottom line is, if you look even at a 20 kilometer DRO, and that's a nice stable orbit, even at a 20 kilometer DRO, you're only saving about 4% of the total radiation dose you would get when you account for the outbound trip, the duration of stay at Phobos, and the return trip. And once you get down on the surface, depending on which launch window, you know, you're getting 25 up to 34% reduction in the total radiation dose. And these calculations were made with the Olkiris model. We did them at JSC and at Langley, got consensus on them, and so it takes into account secondaries and you know, the whole picture as well as we know it. So take-home point here is there's significant radiation reduction by staying on the surface of Phobos. And Harley, people can ask questions as we go, or do you want to wait till the end and do it all at once, or how would you like to do that?
Is folks will ask questions as they go, but also at the same time, most of the questions still arrive near the end.
Okay, that sounds great.
So keep on, yeah, keep on going.
Now, this is Ted Sweetser. Does that 34% reduction include, I mean, what if you went down into a crater that was facing Mars?
Yeah, and that's a great point. In fact, if you read the fine print here, this assumes a 10-degree crater rim. If you went, you know, to the bottom of Stickney, it would be better.
Thank you.
You know, and we're working all that stuff now, but, you know, there's other considerations in terms of communications for low latency teleapps to Mars surface and back to Earth and so forth, and lighting and things like that. But yeah, absolutely, you could get more in the crater. And the other thing I would just say on this is, you know, Mars is only 9,000 kilometers away from Phobos. And when you look at our simulator, which I unfortunately won't show you today because the video is not working, it looks like Mars is like right in your face, and it's really impressive. And in fact, that's, you have to think that if you go to Phobos, you're going to see Mars, and you know you're going to have the will to make that next step. But Mars itself only reduces the radiation by about 4 to 5%, as big as it looks. So the majority of it is coming from Phobos being right underneath you. Okay, moving on to slide 8. So when we started this program, we were building on some work that Dan Mazurak and the SMD folks did, and we expounded that. We worked with Paul Abel and Stan Love and Dan Britt and others, and we wanted to come up with a reference science program. That doesn't mean this would be the one we'd end up doing, but we wanted to come up with a standard reference science program that we could use to evaluate different architectures, different work system methodologies, timelines, consumable uses, and so forth. And so without going into great detail on this, we identified 11 areas of scientific interest across pretty much all around the moon. On to slide 9. And so these 11 regions, we then broke each region into 5 subsites. These are smaller subsites of about 100-foot diameter. And then within each subsite, we have a standard circuit of tasks that we do. And we developed these standard tasks working with the science community when we were looking at going to an asteroid. And these will not be the exact science tasks that we will do when we get there, but they're representative of that. And it gave us a reference point to compare different architectures and so forth. And basically, the tasks include doing a survey, an airfield survey, doing 2 float samples, a soil sample, a core sample, a hammer chip sample, and then an instrument deployed task. And as we come into each region, we do this near-field survey where we basically document everything. So within that, we've developed 16 very detailed EVA timelines for doing these tasks. And these were developed at the level we would develop an EVA for a space station assembly mission. So a lot of detail went into that. Okay, that's enough for slide 9. On to slide 10. So we then took all these tasks that would make up doing this exploration science mission, and we decompose them, and I'm not going to bore you with all the details, but, you know, what were the distances, what were the accuracies, what was positional and locational alignment actions need to do the task, what were the force to do the task. And so we developed all of that because I always like to start with the task. You know, I don't like it if you have to force fit something into it. So let's just see what the tasks are. And from that, we then developed functional requirements. And then we had a several-week brainstorming session both across the agency, and we had the Rhode Island Institute of Design class there. We got the kids involved and just brainstormed and came up with a bunch of wild ideas, some good, some bad. And from that, we basically down-selected to 3 different work system concepts. And I'm going to not go on to slide 11. And those work system concepts included jetpacks, where we would actually have a spare jetpack serve as a mobile payload carrier. So that would carry your instruments and some of your tools and so forth. So that was one concept. And then we had this unpressurized excursion vehicle. And think of this as a scooped-up Segway with hopper legs, RCS jets. It would, you know, had lighting. It could carry your tools. It had batteries, so it's plenty of power to run power tools and so forth. It could carry your sample bags. And then the third class was the pressurized excursion vehicle, where we would do 1 to 2 week excursions in this vehicle, and I'll talk more about that later. Okay, that's slide 11, and now on to slide 12. And I should have said, when we started this, the calculations of guys jumping up and down and all that were based on the published escape velocity of 11.4 meters per second. But we got our smart guys with Copernicus to start looking at this in more detail. And it turns out that there's some very low energy escape pads from Phobos when you look at it as a three-body problem with its spin rate and Mars tidal effects and so forth. And basically at the anti-Mars point and the sub-Mars point, there are escape paths as low as 2.84 meters per second. So that's just about right at the level where you could almost escape by jumping off the planet. Okay, that's slide 12 going on to slide 13. The other thing that we always like to do in these studies is to really attack them like we're the crew and flight control team doing the mission. So we actually develop detailed flight rules of how we would execute the mission and so forth. And I won't bore you with all of those, but some of the ones, or one of the ones that really drove our considerations here, were returning to a radiation shelter within 20 minutes in case of an SDE event. And that was a constellation requirement. We used that to drive out a lot of the lunar architectures. So we assumed that as a flight rule. And then we looked at return times on a jet pack. And if you look at this matrix, you see the maximum allowable translation speed. The safer jet pack, we fly that no faster than 0.2 meters per second. So we were looking at something more like an MMU, refuelable and so forth. So we started looking at that at 0.5 meters per second, which is pretty sporty for an open loop jet pack. And then these times show how far you could excurse from a fixed habitat and return within the 20-minute requirement. And this doesn't even assume the time it takes to get into the airlock or the chute port or to clean your suit or anything. So if you're only going 0.5 meters per second, you couldn't excurse more than 500 meters from the habitat. So that really limited, your excursion distances. And if you're going to be there 400 or 500 days, you probably want to go farther than that. So as you go up to, say, 3 meters per second, which, you could actually escape there. You could get up to 2.5 kilometers from the habitat. The other thing I'll tell you, and we have a high-fidelity physics sim of Phobos, is that the gravity levels are anything but intuitive. There are places where you're pulled sideways. Phobos is phase-locked to Mars, and so if you're burning retrograde relative to Phobos, that's actually posigrade relative to Mars. So your orbit goes up, and you make this little hop and then go back into the surface. And so I started thinking about a guy on a jet pad with open loop controls. And you get out there and you're trying to do a burn toward this interesting geological formation. And next thing you know, you're a little higher than you thought. And so you burn again. And next thing you know, you're on an escape trajectory running out of oxygen. And so we said it's probably not smart to be out there with an open loop backpack. And so if you had jet packs, you have to add all the GNC to do targeted burns. You definitely don't want to get going 5 meters per second in a jet pack. Actually, the suits are only certified up to, 2 feet per second, which is around the 0.5 meters per second. So we basically said we don't want to just use a jet pack. And that's where this study left off there on slide 13. So now moving on to slide 14. Then we looked at these pressurized, and I would back up and say that these numbers apply to the unpressurized excursion vehicle as well. And admittedly, you could probably add more avionics on it and so forth and, maybe go a little faster, but we just kind of took a very conservative safety approach and said, let's not go there because we don't want to get on an escape path. So on slide 14, the PEV options we looked at started with an SEV class vehicle, which kind of evolved from the lunar rovers as part of the LAT-2 studies and subsequent studies. And we looked at that with an RCS, a reaction control jet sled. So you'd use prop to fly around, and we assumed monoprop hydrazine. And then we also looked at that with hopper legs. I'll talk more about that later. We looked at an SEV class vehicle with just an RCS sled. We looked at an SEV-based taxi lander, and that's the other thing I failed to mention to you, and it's an important point. All of these missions assume that we pre-deploy assets or none, but that the crew actually inserts into high Mars orbit and then taxis over from the return trip home, the transit vehicle, in a smaller taxi that could be a MAV or an SEV MAV-derived hybrid. And so some of these options actually looked at literally using the MAV that we would subsequently use on Mars surface as a taxi to come over from high Mars orbit. And then it would park there probably in a DRO, and then at the end of the mission you'd get back into it and then transfer back to the return vehicle. Okay. So that's slide 14. Slide 15, and I don't know how much Christine, as you know, about all the work we did with the PEDs, starting with the lunar rover and so forth. But this slide, you still there? Hello? Did I hang up on anything?
I can still hear you in Cleveland.
Okay. All right. I just heard some beeping sound. So this slide just gives you a sense of what it would be like to do exploration from inside a space exploration vehicle. So you got great windows. We actually have an astronaut on an astronaut positioning system. The second pilot astronaut is inside and operating the cameras and so forth, and actually serving as the CAPCOM, communicating with the ground science team across the five-plus minute time delay. Okay, that's slide 15. And then slide 16 just shows that ops con. So you've got this pressurized cabin. I'll talk about that more later. There's an astronaut on an astronaut positioning arm. And it would basically hop off the surface and then use propulsive means to go from site to site. And then within site, we actually looked at a hexapod landulation thing where you would basically shuffle along with these hopper legs and do the individual circuits within a site. Okay, that's slide 16 on to 17. And the whole notion here was, could we come up with a common cabin that is optimized for low-volume, high-performance habitation, and contains good windows for observations, as well as the suit ports that could be a fundamental part of an evolving architecture that could range from a core node for cislunar space to using the same structure as a Mars surface rover, as well as this space exploration vehicle, pressurized excursion vehicle, possibly a Mars ascent cabin as well. So the idea is to try to have a common, as common approach as we can, and optimize across the architecture, not developing just point solutions for specific destinations. Okay, slide 18 is next. So with that backdrop, we then put together a very sophisticated model that combined the Copernicus estimates for the delta Z, going from the DRO to the surface, and then surface-to-surface growth translations. We used the Nexus sim that Zach Cruz and Dan Dexter and his team developed for us, working with JPL to calculate the delta Vs within a given site. We have a logistics calculator that comes out of the Langley campaign team, and that's the standard that we use across the Evolvable Mars campaign, so all that's standardized. We use the habitat estimates coming from Matt Simon and Dave Reeves at Langley. Our detailed EVA timelines were developed by my team and led by Steve Chappell. And then the high Mars orbit to Phobos service module weights were based on data from Terra Positiva up at Marshall. For all the reasons of scientific interest, Paul Abel kind of led that effort up. So this model actually generates mission-level estimates and comparisons of 70-plus figures of merit that include everything from system masses to logistics, crew time, EVA time, EVA overhead, et cetera. So we wanted to really develop this model to fully evaluate all these different architectural options. That's slide 18 going on to 19. And this basically represents a years of work in one slide. And so some of the options we looked at, the first case was, I'm going to go from left to right on the matrix from the top here. The first case was pre-deploy nothing to Phobos. So we actually stage out of high Mars orbit with a PEV-derived taxi, and it's got logistics modules. This was a two-person crew, 50 days duration on Phobos. The PEV with the service module taxi and the logistics weighed 35 tons. We actually left the service module. We parked that in a 20-kilometer DRO orbit, and then flew the PEV down to the surface. We were able to achieve 100% of the science in our reference science program with this configuration. Radiation dose was 97% of what a free space mission for that length of time would take, so we didn't get much of a radiation benefit. And the other point I will make is that I have been, I hate to use the word militant, but we are trying very hard that anything we do for this Phobos mission should be marched forward. We want to develop as little Phobos unique equipment as possible. And so the Phobos specific elements here would be the RCS sled and the optional hopper. So the next option was two PEVs. One would be a taxi, one would be pre-deployed. So we pre-deploy with a SEP to Phobos, PEV, and the logistics for four crews for 50 days. And this cut down the mass of the taxi to 11 tons roughly. And we pre-deploy, I'm sorry, we pre-stage, 11 tons, and the taxi would be 25 tons. Again, we got 100% of the science done. With four crew, that offers options for international participation and so forth. So that was another option. The next option was two PEVs. One is a taxi, and then we would pre-deploy a PEV and a DRO habitat. And again, we could get all the work done there, but with the 20-kilometer DRO, and we were doing two-week excursions in the PEV, we only had about a 6% reduction in the radiation dose, and you actually used a fair amount of prop coming and going back and forth from the DRO hab. So we pretty much ruled that out. And then we looked at a surface hab with two PEVs, one again as a taxi, but having two gives you redundancy both for your exploration operations and as your taxi. This ended up with a pre-deployed, roughly 40 tons, which actually sits within the envelope. The taxi would be 25 tons. We could get all the science done, and depending on the launch date, up to 34% reduction in radiation dose. So the only things here that would be marched forward would be the RCS sled, the hopper, and the HAB landing leg. Then the next option we looked at was, the absolute minimal option, which is to take basically the Mars Ascent vehicle, use that as a taxi, come over from high Mars orbit with two crew, land it, do Apollo-style EVAs where you depressurize the whole cabin, you locked out, planted a flag, got a few rocks, and then came home. I mean, you would move this from site to site. A lot of issues here in the sense that, you've got dust and all that stuff to deal with your suit, so you don't have a suit port or an airlock. But it's a trade we wanted to look at, and it's, as Brett Drake pointed out, it's better than nothing. A lot better than nothing. You're going to a moon to Mars, you're landing there, you're getting samples and so forth. And then the last option that we looked at in the first year, and we're a little on past this now, was a minimal taxi that would be like a habitable airlock, on a MAV-derived service module, and then a mobile habitat. So the habitat could move around the surface to all 11 sites using RCS, and then it had athlete legs, so within a site, it could actually ambulate fairly well. It weighed about, 80 pounds by the time we were all done. Actually, more than that, more like 120 pounds because we actually had the SEP delivery vehicle on it. That's not enough weight to use wheels on Phobos because you've got all that inertial mass, but the athlete legs would allow you to ambulate. And that had a lot of advantages in that you had your taxi with you at all times. Your HAB was always there. You're never far from it, so forth. And that involved pre-deploying about 43 tons. And then we had a minimal taxi at about 13 tons. Okay. That's kind of an overview of slide 19 on to slide 20. And this is kind of an eye chart. It basically just shows the masses, both launch to high Mars orbit and pre-space to Phobos, for the different options. And obviously when you go to the larger halves, you start adding a fair amount of mass for the pre-deployment. That's probably about all I'll say about that. So now on to slide 21. And this just shows the percent of the reference science content completed as a function of the days on Phobos across the different options. And in most cases where you had the mobile hab or the PEVs, you know, you could get the science done in up to 50 days, and that's if you did nothing else. And as we've worked this on further, the OPSCON would be to do two-week excursions, like once a month. And then the rest of the time you're doing care maintenance to hab and low-latency teleops of our service assets or possibly assets over on DMOs. And then the simple lander case that I talked about a minute ago didn't get much of the science done, but again, it was better than nothing. So that just kind of overviews the capabilities there. On the slide 22, this talks more about the hopper, and we worked with Scott Howe and the JPL guys to come up with a conceptual design of this, did a pretty detailed mal. It weighed about 1,461 pounds. And believe it or not, the gravity level is so low to do 135 kilometers of traverses on Phobos only required 10 kilowatt hours of energy. That's about like running your refrigerator for a month, depending on how good a refrigerator it is. So it's very low energy to hop around on Phobos. And we actually combined a CMG for attitude control, and unlike space station, you don't have to burn RCS to desaturate the CMG. As you hit the ground, it actually desaturates the CMG. So it looks like a really promising way to get around on Phobos. Okay, that's slide 22 on to slide 23. And so the question we had is, at what point does the hopper pay for itself in RCS prop savings? And this graph shows the total mass against the regions explored. We had 11 regions. We actually looked at doing up to two missions, and the concept there was that we called a mission and a half. So there'll be a mission to Phobos, and then the next mission would involve a short Mars surface day with the balance of the time spent on Phobos. And the red line is the weight of the hopper, and then the hydrazine, depending on whether we went region to region or out and back from the hab, the hopper would pay for itself in sort of 5 to 7 regions. So it was clearly a big benefit to go that way. Additionally, even when the crew wasn't there, you know, the ground could actually move this excursion vehicle around, you know, for years potentially. So hopper was good. All right, 24. And then this is our mobile hab concept. And the idea here, and we've taken this quite a bit further than I have in these slides. These slides are from an IEEE presentation I gave. They're all ICAR and so forth. So I'm just sort of giving you guys what's out there in the public domain. So the concept there was the hab would use RCS to locate from region to region. And then when you got there, we deploy these EVA structures, support structures, booms, if you like, and slide our PFR up and down these things and work there. We would have a safer jet path, and we would be on tethers. And you know for sure that you're going to get to the end of your boom, and you want to go a little bit farther. And so the idea was, fine, you can excurse with the jet path. As long as you're on a tether, you're not going to go away. That's slide 24. Slide 25 talks about our options of how we go EVA. And if we just had the HAB, which is going to be at 14.7 PSI, 21% oxygen, and we're basically in microgravity, and so we would need to use the in-suit light exercise pre-breathe protocol. I've been the principal investigator of all the pre-breathe protocol developments for years, so I know a lot about it. Anyhow, that takes 3 hours and 39 minutes. If we assumed a 5-minute airlock egress and then 15 minutes to don your jetpack and check it out, 15 minutes to take your jetpack off, we assume 20 minutes to clean your suit, another 10 minutes to ingress the airlock. So you're looking at an overhead of 4 hours and 44 minutes. And on a 6.5-hour EVA, we have this index we call the work efficiency index, which is basically the EVA time divided by the overhead time associated with getting out the door. And so So that results in a work efficiency index of 1.37. Okay, so next slide, which would be slide 26. If we went with a suit port with the exploration atmosphere, in the case of the mobile hab, the taxi that we came over in would be a habitable airlock that would have suit ports that would be capable of operating at the exploration atmosphere, which is 8.2 pounds per square inch, 34% oxygen. And with that, we're able to use suit ports, and this is kind of an overview of that timeline, 20 minutes for suit port egress, the same 15 minutes to pack on and check it out. Suit cleaning would be reduced in the sense that you're using the suit port, and I think most of you know what that is, but it keeps the suit outside of the vehicle. And you can see in these pictures on the bottom, you basically open up a hatch on the inside, you open up the backpack of the suit, and you step into the suit, and then you pick up the procedure on a display that's outside, you close the hatch, and you do your leak check and all that stuff. So anyhow, the total overhead here was 1 hour and 5 minutes, which results in a work efficiency index of about 6. So much better, and you know, we do a little bit of cleaning on the suits, and then the concept is once a month we would clean the suits up really well, you know, take 2 hours to clean them up, and then come in through the airlock on the hab. Okay, that's slide 26 under 27. So this is just more concepts of the mobile hab. I think most of you probably followed the athlete work that Brian Wilcox and team have done at JPL. The idea is we would use appropriately scaled athlete legs, and there's some synergies here with the ARM mission, the ultimate ARM mission to get a big boulder and bring it home, so we try to piggyback those things together. So the mobile hab, as I said before, uses thrusters for gross positioning and then actually ambulates within the site. And that's slide 28 onto slide 29. And then again, you know, picture yourself on Phobos and you're at the end of this boom and you want to go farther. So you would have jet packs and we're looking at using these micro spines that JPL has developed. We're actually evaluating those at a NEMO mission that I'm heading off to on Sunday. And, you know, you could skirt away from the hab on a tether, probably 100 feet plus. Okay, slide 30. These are just sort of concepts of this mobile boom approach or associated with the mobile hab. So they would be deployed and reconfigure to increase the radius, the habitat. Again, you could use jetpacks to expand your range. We've done a whole lot more work on this. It turns out that those booms are great outriggers, and they allow you to really generate a lot of force before you even begin to tilt the hab, let alone topple it. And we're actually looking at using these outriggers on the Hopper PEV again, so that we don't have to anchor. And long story short, even on the light PEV, we can get up to 8 pounds of EVA force application before we begin to tilt. And on the hab, it's depending on where you are along the length of the boom, it's up to hundreds of pounds. So it really sort of negated the need to anchor, which, you know, that's something we don't know a whole lot about, and it was nice that we were able to come up with these work system methods that didn't require anything. Okay, slide 33. I'm about to close this off, but basically what I'm showing here, and this is, again, part of the Evolvable Mars campaign, we want to have as much commonality and synergy across the whole campaign as possible. And if we did the ARM mission, you know, the step would be used on this Phobos mission, the deep space habitat, and our vision is that deep space hab is the same as the Phobos hab and the same or very similar to the surface hab. The service module, again, probably MAV-derived, Orion. The habitat, again, would be the same with the exception of the landing legs. The taxi could use a cabin that would be common with the MAV and common with the Phobos exploration vehicle. And then, of course, the suit ports and exploration atmosphere. So all these things would come out of the cislunar environment, the proving ground, so-called proving ground. Okay, on to slide 34. And these show the additional elements we would need to do Phobos. And so we need to have, it's basically all these things, but the only thing that's not Mars surface forward would be to have landing system and then the hopper and RCS sled of the CEVs. And so that's about as good as we're going to do, but it really, develops the whole transportation infrastructure and many of the end items that we need to do Mars surface. Slide 34 shows the systems that we need to do Mars surface and how they build on what we have for Phobos. So the Phobos are in green, but in addition to the elements that we need to do Phobos, you know, we need an aeroshell, we need a MAV, a surface habitat with the right deployment systems. We need the lander. We need an unpressurized rover, ISRU, nuclear fission, logistics modules, offloading systems, power cable systems, and potentially slightly different exploration suites. So I guess the take-home point here is that there's a lot more things we need to do Mars surface than Phobos, but everything except the hopper and the RCS sled and the landing legs would be buying down risk for the Mars surface mission. Okay, and last slide, 36. So Phobos is a step in the direction of Mars surface. It develops transportation, operations infrastructure. All of the Phobos systems are Mars surface forward except the ones I mentioned. Assuming that SLS, Orion, and exploration suits are happening, then Phobos requires 7 additional developments, which draw heavily from the cislunar ARM mission. The Mars surface mission builds heavily on Phobos investment, but requires 9 more specific Mars surface developments. And many of these are low TRLs like the lander. The whole EDL thing is a huge challenge, the nuclear fission for the ISRU and so forth. So take-home point is that within an evolvable Mars campaign that starts with ARM and the cislunar infrastructure, Phobos is a viable human target that could be a sensible and relatively affordable step to Mars surface while providing meaningful science return and possibly enhancing or even enabling the Mars surface mission via low-latency robotics. So that's all I've got. Looks like it took about 25 minutes. So any questions at this point?
Yeah, Mike, this is Harley. I got a number of questions. Let's see. Back on chart 30, what was this? My eyeglasses are giving out. Back on chart 35, second to last one, the systems needed for Mars surface. There's some folks I've been working with. They've been making presentations on this telecom series, and maybe you've been reading some of the stuff. Have been looking at least for the initial human missions to Mars, to the vicinity of Mars. No, in this case, the initial missions to the surface of Mars. What is the absolute minimum that is necessary for that first mission? Not that that would be your most desired goal or the type of mission that you would want to go to the surface with eventually, but what is the absolute minimum that would get humans to the surface of Mars safely, of course, have some ability to carry out some exploration, science, and perhaps prepare for subsequent missions. The list that you've got here is very ambitious, does not appear to me to be an absolute minimum mission. Have you guys given thought, or do you want to?
Please comment. Fair point, and I should have qualified that this was based on the Mars surface architecture at that snapshot in time, which was, and our direction was to start by looking at, a permanent base for a 500-day mission. And so if you go down a path of, hey, what's the absolute minimum, then absolutely I think you could do it with less than that. What we were asked to evaluate was developing, the full-stay Mars surface mission.
Got it. Which leads to and I figured that was the case, but I wanted to give you the opportunity to answer the question. What is your, and I'm certainly going to give time for other folks to ask questions. What is, and apologies if I missed it, what are your next steps? Where do do you folks want to take this study next? What is going to be the your next goals?
Yeah, so we're continuing to refine all the details, doing more engineering, improving our MELs. We're actually have developed a whole sim that looks at all the lighting and comm on Phobos, so we're starting to do detailed planning of what that would look like. And again, I'm focused just on Phobos. I lead that team. I'm not going to speak to the rest of the Evolvable Mars campaign. Right now, we're working with the direction in, that we have a fixed cab that could be moved a couple times if needed, and we're going to taxi over in a MAV-derived vehicle. And so we're basically just fleshing out those details, you know, sort of at an engineering level, very detailed analysis, coming up with better MELs. And we're also developing some of the low-latency teleops, how that would look in terms of controlling a Mars surface rover and or possibly helping with some of the infrastructure tasks, although the crew isn't always going to be on Phobos, so we need to design those tasks where, you know, they don't have to have the crew on Phobos to do the low-latency teleops.
Okay, do other folks have questions?
Dan Adamo. I'm looking at page 12, and my relative motion eye from FIDO training tells me those leading trailing limb approaches or departures are hazardous. Can you comment on that, and do you expect to see such nonlinearities with respect to Deimos approaches and departures?
Yeah, so that's a good question, and I did comment on it that, yeah, they kind of scare you, and that's why we kind of gravitated away from guys on a jetpack where you could find yourself, you know, in a totally non-intuitive gravitational environment and could easily achieve escape velocity and get in trouble really fast. Deimos is worse. It's about half, roughly. And so for those reasons, we down selected, we ruled out unpressurized excursion vehicles or jetpacks, and so all of our work would be done either with a mobile HAB, which isn't going to go anywhere, or you would be in this pressurized excursion vehicle that has 2 weeks of consumables plus margin, you know, has a total closed loop GNC, so you can do targeted burns and hops. And all of this will be predicated on doing a precursor mission where we totally characterize the gravitational field and all the soil mechanics and all of that. And so when you're in a pressurized vehicle like that, you know, that can do targeted burns based on the data from the precursor, I think we'd be in pretty good shape.
Okay. I'm not sure I'm convinced Deimos is worse in the sense that I'm more concerned with seat-of-the-pants flying, which would possibly be easier if these trajectories were more linear at Deimos.
To be honest with you, we haven't done this level of analysis at Deimos, but we also have developed a very high-fidelity physics sim of Phobos with its gravity field, polyhedral model. We have a detailed design of the PEV, you know, right down to the thrusters and the CG and so forth. And we've done a fair amount of flying around, and we've developed techniques where we do targeted burns. For example, we actually have a laser that we can point where we want to go, and it looks at the range, and it would have a gravity model, and it would do the hop-burn combination to get you there. So there would be very little seat of the pants flying because we'd have this sophisticated GNC system. And on Deimos, you know, the gravity is roughly half, and so the escapes velocities would be about half. And you would still need absolutely to have, you know, that ability to do targeted burns and so forth. And you would have an easier chance of actually escaping on Deimos just because the escape velocity is lower. But
okay, well,
that,
thank you.
Demos is interesting, and don't take any of this to say that we wouldn't actually consider going to Demos. It's actually easier to get to from a Delta V point of view, and we were starting to look at that in more detail, and for now we've decided just to down select Phobos. We are working with SMD, and of course they're doing a lot of work that beyond what we're doing, but we're formulating aspects of a precursor mission that we would need to know for our human mission, and we would actually like to have a lander that's a hopper that has propulsive capability as well, and literally go to all the sites that we think the humans are going to go to, and you know, every time that thing hopped, you would be learning something about the soil mechanics, and soil stability and so forth.
Well, thank you, Mike. That was interesting, and I appreciate Chart 12 greatly. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, again, other questions? The questions for Mike?
See, this is Jim Head at Brown University. Mike, I was wondering, in your design reference missions for the science traverses, what were you considering for payload down mass and sample return up mass kind of things?
Yeah, good question. We were assuming the 250 kilograms of sample return with atrazine. And we have, I'm not sure I'm going to get this exactly right, but we've specced out tools, core samples, float samples. We've actually built some prototype tools that we're evaluating on NEMO 20, and it's on the order with all this stuff. I think it was like 500 pounds, and that included cameras and sensors and stuff, or 500 kilograms.
500 kilograms,
okay. So it's a pretty good science package.
So is this the kind of thing when you do, different visits, it's 250 per visit or up mass, or is that the total you can bring back? What's the constraint?
No, that's the total you can bring back, but there are hybrids, and again, all of this CMC stuff is a work in progress. But one of the things that I got excited about is if we have this ChemSep reusable hybrid and we're doing a MAV-derived taxi, we actually have the capacity to bring more than 250 kilograms back from Phobos to high Mars orbit. And if we're getting rid of the trash that we had on the outbound trip, then that creates a vacancy for more samples. And then as the crew comes back and they have, inserts into lunar DRO, and then depending on architectural assumptions, there are some flights that come up with Orion to deliver the crew, but then it doesn't come home with the crew, so there would be Orions available in cislunar that you could potentially pack full of these samples to bring home. The 250 kilograms was sort of set as the weak link in the return to Earth. If you had an unmanned Orion that could come back to Earth from cislunar space, there is the possibility of bringing many more samples back.
Now that sounds fantastic. As you know, we can always use as much as we can get. Thanks a lot.
Well, and that's interesting. And, I've had great support from the science community. And, I get that loud and clear. And I've done a lot of work with the geology guys on desert rats and so forth. Right now, one of the things that we're looking at, and I'd be interested in your comments on this, but is there's a desire for absolutely pristine samples, right, with no cross-contamination with anything. And so we've developed, working with Stan Love and the EC guys, a set of tools we're evaluating at NEMO where you basically have a one-shot end effector that grabs a sample, and then you bag that, and that end effector never touches another sample. And I think the notion is, get some absolutely pristine ones that there's no cross-coupling on, and that sort of serves as your control group, and then use less mass fraction sampling devices to get more samples. And then, we have to sort through sort of a high grading, what would that look like? And, as we did in rats, we would, continue to bring samples back to the HAB and keep a leaderboard list, and the science guys on the ground are thinking about all this, and at the end they say, these are the top priority ones, and you probably cast the other ones back on Phobos so that if you got them back to Earth and found out something new, you could go back and get some more of the cached samples. But that's a whole plan that would need to be developed.
Yeah, the pristine is really good, obviously, but there's also triage that can go on too, I think, as you're saying, once you get back into the HAB.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also the other point is that, you know, we've been doing some work on the amount of Mars ejected it actually reaches Phobos and where it might be based on, you know, essentially the unusual aspects of the orbit, as you were pointing out. So, you know, there's some guidelines there that can be helpful in terms of the amount of mass you'd have to go through to get a good Mars sample and where that might be on the surface and what depth, et cetera. So I can send you some of that as well.
Yeah, no, I'd be interested. I read a paper or scanned a paper on that, and, apparently it's not in big chunks, so you kind of have to look for it, is what I understand. Is that true?
That's great. We're talking sieving here, pretty much. It would be more also like the Apollo. What we did on Apollo for that was the rake, too, so where you can you know, quickly filter out larger chunks and identify them rapidly as whether they come from Mars or not.
Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing, and again, all this is a work in progress, but one of the things that we would love to do is to look at doing a Mars surface sample return that could be combined with this Phobos mission where, for example, we could, you know, you could launch that Mars surface sample into high Mars orbit and we could rendezvous and capture it with the taxi that we use to go back and forth to Phobos. So a lot of options. And then I won't even bring up the whole Cootie discussion about, but we're working closely with folks at headquarters on the planetary protection and defense stuff, and, you know, there's a lot of interest on that. But the general thought is that Mars surface samples on Phobos would be, you know, basically irradiated for millions of years and probably not contain cooties that could hurt somebody.
Yeah, I think that's generally true. Thanks very much.
Mm-hmm.
That's a technical microbiological term, is it not, Mike? Cooties?
Yeah, it is. It is. I like it.
Yeah, okay. Folks can look it up online to find out the formal definition of a cootie. Other questions for Mike? Okay, great. Mike, thanks very much. Thank you. A very, very timely. And thank you for taking the time to present to us. So, everybody, talk to you all next week.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Good question.
Yeah.